I am unwilling to give up, that I will start over from scratch as many times as it takes to get where I want to be.
You just want to make sure you will get knocked down, but just make sure you don't get knocked out.
So your only choice should be go focus on what you can control.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Kara Golden Show. Join me each week for inspiring conversations with some of the world's greatest leaders. We'll talk with founders, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and really some of the most interesting people of our time. Can't wait to get started. Let's go. Hi, everyone. It's Kara Golden from The Kara Golden Show, and I am so excited to have my next guest here. We have Tim Chi, who is the CEO of The Knot Worldwide. But Tim is a serial entrepreneur, in addition to being a CEO. And I'm super, super thrilled to hear all about his journey and his experience. As I mentioned, he is a serial entrepreneur, not new to the startup world. He had actually co-founded another company some years ago called Blackboard, which was early ed tech days, really incredible. And then he went on in 2005, when he was actually trying to plan his own wedding, to co-found a company called Wedding Wire. And it's such a fascinating story. He founded that company in 2007 and then led the company from an internet startup to a multi-million dollar leader in the wedding planning industry, then led the merger of Wedding Wire with The Knot and its collective brands to bring it all under one umbrella. The new company is called The Knot Worldwide, is now the largest provider of wedding marketplaces in the world, including website, planning tools, registry services, all of that in 16 countries, including North America, Europe, Latin America, et cetera. So a wild ride for sure. So I'm super excited to have Tim here to talk a little bit more about not only the build of his companies, but also the scaling and what he's learned about the wedding industry. What are his predictions going forward for all things weddings as well? So super excited to have you here, Tim.
Kara, thanks so much for having me on the show. It's a real honor.
Super, super excited. So let's talk a little bit about you first. And I'd love to hear, you know, did you always know that you would be an entrepreneur and that you would be one day leading the giant of all things weddings?
Definitely not. The answer is no. I did not think any of that. You know, I grew up in Southern California, and I'd say one that sort of probably contributes a little bit to my laid back, relaxed style. But more importantly, when I think about influences early on in my life, you know, two things jump to mind. Number one is definitely my mom was a big influence early on. She was and is still to this day the ideas person. She's the one always saying, you know, whenever we see each other, why hasn't someone figured out something like this? Or I have an idea. And they're, you know, we joke a lot about her crazy ideas, and occasionally they're not half bad. But that sort of spirit and enthusiasm and sort of curiosity really left a mark on me. And then second, you know, just reflecting back again, my parents were immigrants from Taiwan. They moved here in the 70s. They were dual, you know, we were a dual working family, both parents. You know, my dad was an architect. My mom was a real estate broker. And, you know, my childhood is really filled with, you know, watching firsthand how to build a small business and actually just how hard it was every day. After school, I'd get picked up by one of them, you know, taken to their small office. I'd sit at my dad's drafting table until work was over, and then we kind of all go home together. You know, there wasn't a lot of after school activities and all the stuff, you know, that happens right now. And I really, that kind of really shaped, you know, my view sort of ultimately on entrepreneurship and gave me some, you know, early influences.
So interesting. So what was your first job out of college?
Yeah. So my first job was in entrepreneurial, well, my first job in high school was an entrepreneurial endeavor that failed really badly. My again, growing up in Southern California, my we like clean cars, and so we'd wash our cars a lot, and it was sort of a pastime. And one of my buddies and I, you know, felt like we were really good at washing cars. So in high school, we pooled our allowance together and all the money that we've earned, and we went out, bought all this professional car washing gear, and you know, we got all the supplies. We knew we could do the job, and we sort of just, you know, figured out how to print some business cards and walk around and, you know, put stuff in mail slots, and nobody showed up, of course. So that was a real lesson in the fact that, you know, there's a thing called marketing and a thing called sales. And just because you're good at doing one thing doesn't mean the rest of the world cares. And so that was, graciously, I think our parents really, you know, ended up trying to offset some of the deep investment we made. But that was a real first foray into entrepreneurship for me.
I love it. And then you went on to launch, co-found Blackboard. So yeah. How did that idea come up?
So yeah, Blackboard was co-founded in 1998. Right before that, through just a lot of serendipity, a bunch of college buddies and I, we were at university. And at that time, we went to school in upstate New York at Cornell. And so it gets really cold and snowy there. And as students, sort of this gets to the, you know, personal pain point angle of a lot of entrepreneurship stories. We dreaded, walking across campus to turn in our homework, you know, when there's 8 feet of snow outside. And at that moment,
how often have you thought about learning a new language only to be stopped by that memory of yours from the last time you tried to learn a language when it didn't go so well? Okay, maybe it wasn't a language that you were interested in learning, or perhaps all those poorly written textbooks in your sixth grade class weren't that well written after all. I have a great tip for you. It's called Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program around. Available on desktop or app, no matter where you choose to learn it or what platform you choose to learn on, Rosetta Stone works, and it truly immerses you in the language you choose to learn, quicker and easier than you ever imagined to. Maybe you're getting ready to travel abroad this summer and you want to learn a bit of Portuguese, let's say, before your trip. Rosetta Stone can help. I know this firsthand as I did just this before traveling to Portugal last year. I learned Portuguese through Rosetta Stone, and by doing so, I not only got a better grasp of the spoken language of Portugal, but it got me very excited for the trip itself before I went. They even have a true accent feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation as you are learning too. They've got you covered. Rosetta Stone's trusted experts are the real deal. They've been helping people just like you for over 30 years, helping millions of people to learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and my favorite, Portuguese. The lessons are 5 to 10 minutes long and include practical exercises so that you can pick up the language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. No English translations either, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you are focused on, helping you get the long-term retention you are looking for. And who wouldn't want that? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Kara Golden Show listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Thinking about what's for dinner, but you haven't had a minute to even think about it before now? Well, let's not make that mistake again. I have a tip for you. Factor. Stress-free, delicious, ready-to-eat meals, just perfect for spring and summer yumminess. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes or less. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options: keto, vegan, veggie, or calorie smart. Factor has you covered. Discover more than 60 add-ons every week, too, like breakfast and on-the-go lunch choices. Snacks and beverages now, too. Stay fueled and feel good all day long with whatever they are creating over at Factor for you. And the best part, each meal is ready to eat in just 2 minutes or less. And who wouldn't want that? Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Get started today and fuel up for your spring and summer goals. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/golden50 and use code golden50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code golden50 at factormeals.com/golden50 to get 50% off plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. That's code golden50 at factormeals.com/golden50 to get 50% off plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Moment in time, sort of mid-90s, in colleges and universities really had invested a lot in infrastructure. And by that, I mean, you know, wiring up campuses for, you know, with Ethernet ports, et cetera. But the software they had running on top of that was really simple. You know, it was kind of like maybe add drop, you know, Bursar, paying your bills, maybe add drop classes. There wasn't really any software out there that was facilitating teaching and learning online, both for faculty, administration, as well as students. And so we decided that we'd, you know, give a shot at building software that could sit on top of this large infrastructure environment investment and do stuff like, you know, that we're all familiar with today. You can check your grades online. You can turn in your homework. You can have virtual office hours. And that really became one of the early sort of course management systems or learning management systems that we're all familiar with today. So that was kind of the first version of that. It was a lot of fun. We you know, were able to sell some software to universities and then, you know, graduated college and, you know, sort of formally formed Blackboard when we found another group to merge with. And that was a really fun experience that was quite successful, you know, fortunately for us.
That wild. I mean, it was really one of the first ed tech companies. Were they even calling it ed tech?
No, that wasn't even a thing. No, that wasn't a thing. We were kind of, you know, making the category as we went along. And, you know, timing is important always in some of these things. You know, it was well-timed, you know, given where we were in the sort of infrastructure cycle at that time, an IT cycle.
That's incredible. So then jumping forward, you ended up co-founding Wedding Wire. And can you share a little bit more about that backstory?
Sure. So, you know, mid-2000s roll around and we had, again, the great fortune of taking Blackboard public. Company was much bigger at the time. And I wasn't looking to do anything different, but I just, you know, as we were aging here and, you know, being in relationships, I met my now wife, Tracy, and 2005 was our wedding. And yet again, you know, just going through the wedding planning process firsthand, sort of scratched that personal pain point itch again. And I sort of just thought to myself, wow, there's so many great resources available for helping engaged couples sort of get inspired and design a vision and really craft something that is unique and different. It really represents, you know, two people coming together. At the same time, planning a wedding is really, really hard and super frustrating and stressful and very expensive. And there's no one really helping to make that part of wedding planning better, sort of the doing part versus the dreaming part. And so that was really the impetus of Wedding Wire. We, you know, set out and really focused on local marketplaces and creating that as the backbone of Wedding Wire. And really where we rooted the value proposition was in consumer reviews. And if you recall, Kara, at that time, that was sort of that timing was sort of the birth of vertical marketplaces in general. You know, you had Yelp come along, you had TripAdvisor, et cetera, et cetera. And so reviews, you know, and user-generated content was sort of a real novelty then. And we kind of, at Wedding Wire, we really focused on aggregating those and really providing value to future engaged couples in terms of helping them select the right perfect vendors for their wedding.
So interesting. Well, you and I were talking before we started recording that, you know, there was somebody else in the wedding space. You know, The Knot was one of the big ones. There's probably a few others that were in the space. So you definitely were not the first. You know, unlike with Blackboard, you were one of the first. So you weren't creating a category, but you were obviously doing something different. Did you ever in a million years imagine that you would be running the Knot or merging with the Knot? I mean, was that ever something that you thought would ultimately happen?
Definitely not in the early days, right? Well, the way we, my co-founders and I, Sunny Lee and Jeff, we, our sort of mental model for building the business is really brick by brick. We kind of didn't pattern, we weren't patterning ourselves off the Knot in other leading wedding brands so much. We were actually following the playbook more of other vertical local marketplaces like OpenTable and Yelp, et cetera, and really focused on, you know, building a durable, sort of high liquidity local marketplace city by city. So we launched in DC and then we went to Baltimore and then we went to Philly and then New York. And so that was actually the game plan because we just felt like, you know, local marketplaces in of themselves are really, they take time to really build and scale up. But once you get some traction going, they're harder to break. And so we really, you know, did take our time and really focus on building it that way with the hopes, of course, of one day, you know, certainly not running everything, but, you know, figuring out a way to partner or, you know, but whatever. But we were really just focused on, you know, building a sustainable, durable company. And that was kind of the approach we took.
It's so interesting that you say that because I feel like as I was working with my team to build Hint too, and, you know, I looked less at the beverage industry and I looked around more at what other people were doing and what problems I could ultimately solve for the consumer, which I think is exactly what you're talking about. You're looking at other people for ideas while, you know, maybe people are saying, oh, you know, you're competing against the Knot. You never really, I mean, you didn't focus on that on a daily basis. You were definitely keeping maybe one eye on sort of what was going on over there, but you were really looking at how can I improve this experience for the consumer?
That's exactly right. And one investor once said to me that disruption or, you know, disintermediation often comes from places you don't expect it to. And so I really took that to heart in everything. It's kind of like, it often comes from the, you know, you got to be looking all over the place because it's not always obvious where the stuff comes from, you know, and particularly in today's day and age when it's, things move so fast, you know, it's always important to keep that in mind that it might, you know, that your largest competitor might not be, right, the place where real change is, real innovation, real change comes from.
So true. I think it's less likely, you know, people said to me for years, you know, look out for Coke and Pepsi. And I, you know, I said, that's not really where it's going to come from. It's going to come from somebody who comes from a different industry, who's trying to solve problems, and they've got capital, they've got ideas, and they'll come in and do things differently because they're hungry. Maybe they've failed a few times before.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sure you you understand exactly what I'm talking about. So you continue to build, growing Wedding Wire to a huge success, over 1,000 employees. How did the merger of your two companies come about?
So there's two lenses on the merger of the two companies. Number one is the sort of financial, you know, sort of consolidation lens, right? And so that one is relatively straightforward. If you kind of take a step back and you look and study the pattern of vertical marketplaces in general, what tends to happen is consolidation occurs at certain scale. So, you know, if you think about Zillow and Trulia coming together, you can think about Seamless and Grubhub coming together. You can think about Angie's List and HomeAdvisor coming together. So, you know, just from a pure pattern recognition perspective, there's that angle. So at some point, you know, these things tend to happen. And related to that is, you know, what's the relationship like between the two competitors, myself or, you know, Wedding Wire and XO Group, and particularly myself and the CEO at the time of XO Group. And, you know, I got to hand it to Mike, you know, on the other side, we developed a relationship. We kept in touch with each other. We understood that we were competitors, but that, you know, logically someday, you know, someone might come along and try to put things together. So we maintained a really healthy relationship. We still keep in touch today. And really it was, you know, building off that relationship that we were able to make the deal work.
That's amazing. So how long from the beginning of the discussions until it actually happened?
It was probably, like most deals, there's kind of fits and starts on again, off again. Sometimes timing doesn't work out. Things are moving. So, I would say the on again, off again was probably, course of a year or so. But when things started clicking, they happened very, very fast. Once we knew the stars were aligned, we had a deal. Everything done, end to end, probably in 3 to 4 months from beginning to end. So it moved really, really quickly. Having the relationship and having done the dance and kind of gotten to know each other was a helpful part of building to that moment.
That's amazing. So it wasn't like a banker was introducing you two. You two knew each other, over the years, and you were friendly competitors in some ways at this point.
That's right. Yeah.
So interesting. I just had another guest on. Who was talking about that in a totally different space, in the software space, in podcasts. And he was saying the same thing, that it was his experience was just getting to know, your competitors over the years, because you just never know when you want to merge
never know.
Together.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's such an important piece. So you were at the helm of Wedding Wire for more than 15 years, and then got together with The Knot to form, or EXO, I should say, to form The Knot Worldwide. You've obviously seen huge growth, dramatic challenges across the globe, just dropped in and said, "Hi, Tim, we're here through the pandemic." So yep. I'd love to hear, obviously, events like weddings were put on hold or definitely changed for sure. Can you share a little bit about, your story during that time and how you managed?
Certainly. So, the pandemic was a very tough one, not just weddings, but anything that sort of relied on dynamics of people coming together, right? We like to characterize it here, though, as COVID and the pandemic were the largest pause button ever pushed on the wedding industry. And the reason why I think it's a good characterization is because we were all very confident that, the fact there was a pandemic running around didn't really change how couples felt about each other. They just actually weren't able to get the event done and be together with friends and family celebrating. So it wasn't a really question of if weddings are going to be, change a lot. It was just when they would happen again. And that's largely how things played out, right? The moment restrictions got lifted, there was a surge back. You've seen all this media around this, wedding boom and, all this pent-up demand. That 2022 last year was probably and will likely be maybe forever, one of the biggest wedding years ever on record because of that pent-up demand that ran through. So during the time, it was a tough one, right? During the years of the pandemic, it was tough. There's no other way to describe it. What we were able to do, and I'm really proud of our team and really our investor base as well for the support, is as an industry leader, we really felt strongly that it wasn't a time to just sit back and watch out for ourselves. We really thought long and hard about how we can support all the constituents involved in weddings, and namely, a real strong focus on the small businesses that make up this wedding industry. So we're talking now about, DJs and photographers and venues and folks that, are really quite reliant on the cash flow that weddings brings in order to keep their business going. It wasn't a possibility during that time. We were able to put out a $10 million vendor assistance program where we were really just helping these small businesses that have supported us for many years through this time, and helping them navigate government PPP, et cetera, too. But really, it was a live to fight another day. And I know our whole group here felt really proud that we were able to do that.
That's incredible. That's amazing. Do you know what percent of the businesses that you were dealing with didn't make it?
I don't have a clean stat on that. The way that we typically think about attrition within SMB in general, I think the U.S. stat is something like, 18 to 20% of small businesses typically go out of business every single year. The interesting thing with our industry is that, for a lot of these really wonderful wedding professionals, these creative professionals, They can do other things, right? So, you know, if you're a photographer and you're shooting a lot of weddings, there are other types of events or other things that you may be able to shoot to get by. So it's I think a lot of people just pivoted to doing different types of things during that time, and then came back right when weddings were available again. So it's a bit of a tough stat to get it cleanly for us. But I can tell you right now, you know, particularly with 2022, just in terms of the number of businesses that are serving weddings, you know, it's all back. And, you know, people are more so than ever, you know, looking for, in 2022, they were looking for dates to get married. We were really challenged with, as an industry, with supply constraints overall. You know, probably if you had attended any, you might have even attended a Monday wedding or Thursday wedding.
Yeah.
Just simply enough dates to fill all the pent up demand.
I was going to say my niece could not get married in 2022. And now she finally decided that she would go to a different day. So she's getting married on a Sunday. She wanted to get married on a Saturday. And but I can only imagine that, you know, there's a lot of other people that are doing the same thing.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, I think 2023, we still have, you know, a lot of that flowing through. But, you know, it's a little bit easier to find dates. And well, it was a little bit easier to find dates in 2023, but the calendars are really robust and full right now.
Have you seen that people are getting married older? I guess since the beginning of Wedding Wire, I mean, do you think that is, you know, a trend? More people are getting older?
You know, it has shifted a little bit, right? I think average ages, I don't have this set off the top of my head, but, you know, over time, over the past decade, certainly things have trended a little bit older as well.
So I feel like you obviously started Wedding Wire during that other beautiful time in our world, 2008, 2009, and now you've got another badge, having been through the pandemic. So, you know, you are a seasoned, you know, scary time leader for sure. What has been kind of the hardest lessons that you've learned as an entrepreneur? I mean, I think you seem very zen about it. And I always know that the leaders that have been through both of these, which I certainly have as well, that allows you to just know that, you know, the sun rises again the next day and, you know, you just do the best you can. But any other lessons that you would, you know, sort of say, here's what you have to do. You're running a company. I don't know, have enough cash in the bank for a rainy day or, you know, any of those things.
Well, I mean, certainly there's the financial consideration and sort of, you know, try to build a healthy company, but those are sort of the obvious ones. You know, my advice would be just to remember, right, that in times of crisis, all eyes are on you. You know, as the CEO, as your senior leadership team, and it's important how you behave and act during that time, really to try to make it through. One of the things that we talk a lot about here at TKWW and sort of speaks to that is, I don't know if you've heard of this, Kara, it's called the Stockdale paradox.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it, but I don't know that much about it. But
so there was it's named after he was a naval officer, James Stockdale. You can look it up. He was a Vietnam POW. But sort of the upshot is he survived a really harrowing time because he sort of credited to this paradox where you internally and externally to others can strike a balance between realism, and for him it was, I am probably not going to get out of here, with optimism at the same time of, no, but I will get out of here, and finding that sort of pragmatic, optimistic, but realistic tone is really, really important during that time, because you can't sugarcoat anything when the world is, you know, blowing up around you and you can see it. At the same time, you can't be without hope, right? And so we've sort of always thought about that in just terms of how we're communicating with our team members, how we're communicating externally to our constituents of, yes, it is tough, but we will get through it. That's kind of the the underlying principle there, and the words that you use and sort of how we say it, and then how we behave really do matter during that time. So that's kind of like the one thing that I always come back to during, you know, times of adversity or challenge.
Yeah. And I think that speaks to what people are looking for in their leaders of companies that they join, because they want to know who Tim is, right? Yeah. They might not, you know, need to know what kind of socks he wears, but, you know, it's like, I mean, they just want to know who he is and you know, and what he believes and how he leads. I think that is absolutely so key, whether you're running a public company or a private company. Yep. I think it's super, super important. So you've met a lot of entrepreneurs. You obviously are one. You're also a very incredible leader, too. I'll say that.
Thank you.
But what are like the 2 to 3 traits that you really see coming out of successful entrepreneurs in any industry that you've seen?
I mean, certainly the ones that I admire, and someone gave me this advice a long time ago. I think good entrepreneurs, good leaders, they look for, and I always take this to heart too, you look for opportunities to build trust whenever you can. In every interaction you have, build a little bit more trust with the person you just talked to, because that ultimately, I find that has so much goodness that comes in ways that you wouldn't imagine over time. And it's something that everybody sort of wants and desires. And so the way you can do those things, right, even just, you know, just making sure what you say and how you behave match, being thoughtful about others and caring, even just when you meet someone for the second time, you know, remembering their name and something about their family or what they talk to you about. I mean, just there's a bit of a be a good human, but also just building trust, I think, is really one of the things that I admire most about, you know, other leaders. And it's something that, you know, I always think about a lot. And then the second carrot ad is just around being a good listener and being empathetic as well, and really, you know, genuinely, authentically letting that come through. I think in today's day and age, there's so much stuff floating around all the time. And, you know, as a leader, it's your job to drive, you know, drive the vision and ambition and purpose and all of that, but you can do so in a way that's respectful and empathetic and being a good listener. And you know, if you can, for me, those are the qualities that I really aspire to and try to get better at, because ultimately I think those translate into a lot of good entrepreneurship, sort of foundational qualities that other people just will gravitate towards over time.
So interesting. So is it tougher to start a company or scale and lead a company? So you've done it. You've done it all. And what would you say is tougher?
Whoa, geez, that's a tough question. That might be one of the toughest questions. It's all hard,
right?
It's all hard for different reasons. I would answer that question. I mean, it kind of depends on who you are. You know, for me, I really, really enjoyed, although I would say the toughness level was very difficult, the earlier stage, just because of the volatility and the emotional roller coaster ups and downs. Like, you got to have a lot of resilience and kind of rose colored glasses to get through that. At the same time, you know, scaling up is a real challenge. I think it just requires a real different skill set, right?
And yeah.
The types of people you surround yourself with, and when to use process, when to not use process. And, you know, for us now at the Not Worldwide, you know, we have employees in countries all over the world and managing different time zones and different cultures and all of that. It's definitely has its own set of challenges. In all of those things, though, I would tell you, Kara, that the one thing that I've always appreciated is every single stage, every single, stage of growth, every single chapter we're opening and closing, man, what a learning opportunity it has been every step of the way. That's really why I feel so fortunate and lucky to get to do what I do, because it's really, really neat to be able to learn and experience all these things all the way through, you know, from startup to where we are today.
Yeah, so cool. So you mentioned this, that starting companies, you've obviously done that. You've had a lot of no's along the way from, you know, people don't want to fund your company or they don't think it's a great idea. You know, there's a lot of highs and lows that go along with those days. How do you deal with those highs and lows and those no's? I mean, do you think it takes a special person to be able to, you know, kind of brush that stuff off? And maybe it is compartmentalizing, as you mentioned before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great that's a great example that you gave earlier. But how do you deal with that? I mean, for people who are sort of sitting here really struggling with, like, this is nobody wants my stuff or that I'm selling. I mean, it's tough. Or, you know, they can't figure out why they're not able to raise the money that they want. Or you know, what do you do?
Because I think resiliency is a thing. Your question reminds me of a book and the author I'm a big fan of, and I forget which one of his books, but I don't know if you're familiar with Dan Pink. Dan, and I think he lives in Bethesda here too. So Dan, if you're listening to this, please give me a call. I'd love to meet. Dan talks about, I think it's in one of his sales related books, this notion of buoyancy. Uh-huh. And he was tracking, you know, sales reps, right? And I remember the story very well of one person he featured who was like a door-to-door vacuum sales cleaner. It's a vacuum cleaner salesman. And who just never lost optimism and was able to compartmentalize, rationalize, or whatever you want to call it, why people were saying no to him. And that just let this person keep going and keep going and keep going. And so... I always thought this notion of buoyancy is an important one. For me, how that shows up is finding outlets, right, to just really take my mind off things and not dwell. My personal outlet, and I have four young kids, and the two younger ones, I've gotten totally hooked to my wife's chagrin on video games because I'm a huge video gamer and I love doing it. And it's my outlet. And now I get to share that experience with my kids on the weekends, and we just kind of sit around and play video games, have a lot of fun together, and sort of the world melts away. And you know, you find a way to reset and get back, you know, on Monday with a fresh perspective.
I love it. Well, you would be my son's favorite person because he's always looking for new victims to come in. He's a senior in high school, and he's, you know, got games going on all over the world, and he's definitely, I feel sorry for people when they walk in and they walk in. Yeah, they're like, oh, you know, and then they lose and they'll leave my house until they win a game. It's a lot. So super fun.
I'm unfortunately too familiar with being on the losing side of that one, but it's still a lot of fun.
Well, he teaches me a lot about that because he's got, you know, now games have changed so dramatically and it's amazing what can be done. So, last question, best advice you've ever received?
Best advice I've ever received. I touched on this a little earlier, but I would end with build a little more trust in every interaction you have. It's really one that I think a lot about for us here at the company and just kind of the way that I try to live my life. You know, one good way, small things, thoughtful things stand out, you know, so just try to do that little extra special unexpected thing in whatever that is. And that matters, particularly in this day and age. And so, you know, sort of, again, getting back to being a good human, but like try to build a little more trust. Just think about ways you can build a little more trust in every interaction you've had. I think that would be my advice to anyone.
I love that. Well, thank you, Tim. This has been incredible. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again for listening to The Kara Golden Show. If you would, please give us a review and feel free to share this podcast with others who would benefit. And of course, feel free to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of our podcast. Just a reminder that I can be found on all platforms at Kara Golden. And if you want to hear more about my journey, I hope you will have a listen or pick up a copy of my book, Undaunted, which I share my journey, including founding and building Hint. We are here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great rest of the week and 2023. And goodbye for now. Before we sign off, I want to talk to you about fear. People like to talk about fearless leaders, but achieving big goals isn't about fearlessness. Successful leaders recognize their fears and decide to deal with them head on in order to move forward. This is where my new book, Undaunted, comes in. This book is designed for anyone who wants to succeed in the face of fear, overcome doubts, and live a little undaunted. Order your copy today at undauntedthebook.com and learn how to look your doubts and doubters in the eye and achieve your dreams. For a limited time, you'll also receive a free case of Hint Water. Do you have a question for me or want to nominate an innovator to spotlight? Send me a tweet at Kara Golden and let me know. And if you like what you heard, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow along with me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Kara Golden. Thanks for listening.